Well, in 2 Samuel 11 and 12, we have a great debacle in Israel when David determines not to live up to the standard that he had pledged himself to. But in chapter 13, everything seems to start falling apart in a rather rapid pace when Absalom's sister is abused by her half-brother Amnon, and then Absalom murders Amnon, after which Absalom flees, and then Absalom finally comes back in chapter 14, and that's where we left off last week, and we're ready for chapter 15. The last part of chapter 14 shows the semi-sincere, I suppose, reconciliation between David and Absalom. David has not done his duty in taking care of the situation with Absalom's sister Tamar. Absalom has taken it into his own hands to slay Amnon and deceive his father. They've been estranged. There's no real repentance, no real forgiveness in some ways, but the cold kiss that he gives Absalom, I doubt, means very much. And so in chapter 15, verse 1, after this, it happened that Absalom provided himself with chariots and horses and 50 men to run before him. I believe that Absalom would give us the quintessential picture of a politician. He knows what to do. He even kisses more than the babies. He kisses the grown men. He is a public figure. He wants his name before them. If you're number one, you have to get your name out there and your presence out there and get your ideas out there. And he does all of this without the benefit of the modern technology. We're told in verse 1 that he provided himself with chariots and horses and 50 men to run before him. David, in the meantime, appears to be not doing that much. In fact, if you hear anything that Absalom is saying, if David were a ball of fire, and he is really getting to these court cases and just taking care of business as he has done in the past, Absalom's comments, I don't think, could have stood. If David has slowed down a little, and maybe what's happened to him has slowed him down some, that just furnishes more material to Absalom to say what he does about David. You're not going to get justice in this man's court. He needs to be replaced. I know a very good man who's available, and he will hear your courts. And when he gets through deciding, both cases are going to be thrilled with the result, which is an impossibility. But that's, you know, if you're a politician, you can promise anything. And so David is slowly losing control of his kingdom, as we see in this first few verses of chapter 15. And it's by his son's doing, if not, as we've suggested, possibly partly by David's doing, by David's example, what David has done, how things have been in disarray, how his own son has turned against him, and now his own son is campaigning against him. There's a lot that's going on. So it's like a disease in the body is just gradually growing, and David seems to be utterly and blissfully unaware of it. It's like a situation where there's an apostasy in a Christian, and he just gets worse and worse, and he doesn't even realize he's losing his fervor for the Lord, and he's taking in more and more of this world. Or a church situation where a church is gradually drifting away from their moorings and going back out to open sea without chart or compass or anchor. And then it's like a dictator in a country who starts with the little things that are very good. The people are all pleased. He tells them, we're going to do better and better things. They start to get jobs. They start to make money. Next thing you know, he has them all under his thumb and he declares war, and his name is Adolf Hitler. True story. And so you see, all kinds of things can happen very gradually over a period of time. That's what seems to be happening here before our eyes in chapter 15. Absalom is running for king. He's thrown his hat into the ring. He looks kingly. He has the pomp. He has the kingly circumstances, the daily parade. This is the campaign that he is engaged in. Jerusalem is not very suitable for chariots. In fact, I think in most wars that were fought in Jerusalem, I don't remember reading of any chariots that played a part in it. People climbed the steep hill to try to get up by a water shaft of some sort, but he's providing himself with chariots and horses and 50 men to run before him. He's got his own private army. I find it interesting over in 1 Kings chapter 1, verse 5, that Adonijah, who's now the son who's replaced Absalom, because Absalom is dead. Adonijah, when he sees his father David on his deathbed, and he thinks he can't live very long, he recognizes that he himself can be the king. And so what does he do? 1 Kings 1, verse 5, Adonijah the son of Haggith exalted himself, saying, I will be king. And he prepared for himself chariots and horsemen and 50 men to run before him. Does that sound familiar? That's what we're just seeing with Absalom here, isn't it? So maybe he took a page out of Absalom's book, which is a little strange because he didn't end very well. Absalom's motive could just be pride. He's a very vain, proud person. I imagine he's bought into his press reports and he's thought he's the handsomest man around, and that's what others are saying. It could be that Absalom is motivated because of the slights of his own father. His father hasn't treated him well. He hasn't disciplined another son that needed it, and he had to take matters into his own hand. It could be that he resents David's affinity for Amnon at the expense of Absalom and others. He tolerated this crook of a son for these years that I was away and couldn't even be around. He forgets all about David's kindnesses. If Absalom has chariots and horses and 50 men, he must have a lot going for him, and a large part of that came through David. And it's so easy for us, once we get a burr under our saddle, to forget that there are many things that are blessings that we're just totally overlooking. And that would stop some of the bad attitudes that people have, I think. But whatever these attitudes and issues are, it's probably a combination of several of these things. He's a fairly complicated fellow. We're told in verse 2, Absalom would rise early and stand beside the way to the gate. So it was whenever anyone who had a lawsuit came to the king for a decision that Absalom would call to him and say, "What city are you from?" He would say, "Your servant is from such and such a tribe of Israel." Then Absalom would say to him, "Look, your case is good and right, but there's no deputy of the king to hear you." And then he would say, "Oh, that I were made judge in the land, and everyone who has any suit or cause would come to me, that I would give him justice." So you can see what's going on here. The courthouse here is the gate. You remember several passages on this. Ruth 4, for example, when it comes time to see who's going to marry Ruth, where is it they go? Ruth 4:1, Boaz went up to the gate. That's like going to the courthouse. And he sat down there, and behold, a close relative came. And then you see it again in verse 10. Ruth the Moabite is the widow of Mahlon, I have acquired as my wife to perpetuate the name of the dead through his inheritance, that the name of the dead may not be cut off from among his brethren and from his position at the gate. You are witnesses this day. That was their courthouse official proceedings. Yes, you get to take this woman to be your lawful wedded wife. You see also this Supreme Court kind of setting. The king would make decisions when the lower courts did not. At least it would go that way. And they would come to him, in verse 2, for a decision. And that's when Absalom would bemoan the fact that there's just a lot of injustice going on in this land. I'm sorry for that. My father's not doing his job. And I can tell you, I've been on the receiving end of this, and it's not very good. My sister was violated. The one who did it got away, and then I'm the one who was punished and exiled. You can't call that justice in any way. So he gets up early. The early bird gets the throne, right? And he tells them about the platform. It's just too bad that I'm not your king. But he makes his campaign promises. Isn't that what politicians usually do? I have the best campaign promises around. I'm going to clean up Jerusalem. I'm going to make everybody happy. Now, let me think with you for a minute. 1 Kings 3. I'm not going to turn there, but you know this account very well. These two women come to Solomon. Both of them claim that their child is the living child. Solomon listens to them. He says, "Bring me the sword." They bring the sword, and he's ready to kill that child and just split him in two and give half to one, half to the other. Now, what does the one who's not the mother do? How does she react? Yeah, kill him. Because she doesn't want this woman to have something she didn't have. What does the real mother say? Give it to the other. Why? She cares for the child. And Solomon said, "Okay, give it to this woman who didn't want him to be killed. She's the real mother." How did the other one go away? Very dissatisfied, very unhappy, because not only does she not get the baby, that other woman gets what she doesn't have, and she doesn't have it. There's envy going on here, apparently. But you see, he couldn't make both of them happy. There's no way for a politician to make everybody happy. You can promise a chicken in every pot, and everybody's going to go away smiling after the decision. But after it's all said and done, somebody's going to win, somebody's going to lose. But here, the way he's talking, it's a typical politician's kind of speech. Oh, that I were made judge in the land, and everyone who has any suit or cause would come to me, and I'd give him justice. I'd see that everybody is happy when I got through. Well, there's no other way than to make somebody happy and somebody sad when it's two going at one another this way. And further, in verse 5, so it was whenever anyone came near to bow down to him that he would put out his hand and take him and kiss him. Now, he's made Israel very impressed with his image, though there's not much more than that. He starts a whispering campaign. Anonymous attacks are very effective sometimes, whether it's in a nation or in a church or in a city. Character assassination is very, very common. And you have him promising not only is there a better way, but I'm going to see to it. I'm going to see to it that everybody's going to be more than satisfied when everyone gets his rights. You're going to have justice done you by the time we get through. Now, David, a hero, can't really compete with Absalom, a celebrity. And that's what you have going on here. How many people today honor a hero as compared to the honor they give to a celebrity? Well, there's no contest. And it apparently was that way here. What has Absalom ever done for his nation compared to what David has done for it? I don't know of anything. But the point of it is, they're mesmerized by this young man, this youth, this vitality, this good-looking young man. That's the kind of man we want. Remember Saul? He's taller than anybody else. This man is better looking than anybody else. We'll have the prettiest king in the world if he becomes our king. Besides that, he's nice. He comes to us, and instead of letting us bow down, what does he do in verse 5? He puts out his hand and takes him and kisses him. He won't let us bow down. He says, I'm no better than you. I'm on the same level as you. If I serve you as king, I'll serve you and not be over you. And then you see he stole the hearts of these people by his humility and his affection. His humility and his affection stole their hearts. Now, what does it mean to steal somebody's heart? You see it in verse 6. Let's put two together. Sorry? You about to say something?
They should be loyal.
They've switched their loyalty. Verse 6 says, in this manner, Absalom acted toward all Israel who came to the king for judgment. So in this manner, Absalom stole the hearts of the men of Israel. He became more popular than David. So that if you look at verse 13, a messenger came to David saying, the hearts of the men of Israel are with Absalom. They're after Absalom. Their hearts, their emotions, their will is all for you, not for David. We want you. We are not wanting David. Now, was David unaware of all this? If he was sort of out of touch, wasn't he? If he wasn't aware of it, he's out of touch, it would seem. If he was aware of it and didn't do anything, he's worse than out of touch. He's not taking care of a major problem that's always going to destroy those who let this happen. Romans 16, 18, just to make a spiritual application of this. For those who are such, and he speaks of those who are divisive in the way they teach, they're teaching error, do not serve our Lord Jesus Christ, but their own belly. You could say that of Absalom here. He's after himself. And by smooth words and flattering speech, that sounds a lot like Absalom, deceive the hearts of the simple. 2 Peter 2:3. By covetousness, it's because of what they want out of you, but they're going to make you feel that I'm going to give you something you want. By covetousness, they will exploit you with deceptive words. For a long time, their judgment has not been idle, and their destruction does not slumber. What you see here then is a battle for the minds. Proverbs 4:23. What does it say about the heart? Guard. Help me. What? With all diligence. Why? Issues of life. Yes. So Matthew 12:35. A good man out of the good treasure of his heart brings forth good things. What does an evil man do? He brings forth evil things. And that's Absalom. 2 Corinthians 4:4. Whose minds the god of this age is blinded, who do not believe, lest the light of the gospel of the glory of Christ, who is the image of God, should shine in them. Any comments before we go on? Steve?
You think by implication here that Absalom was indeed evil? Is it just campaigning per se, but perhaps he was exercising some judgment, making some rulings when the people?
I wouldn't put anything past the man. So it's very possible.
It seemed like that might be part of it. You think about as far as individuals coming to see the king, they say, well, Absalom, he's the king's son. He's probably going to be the future king. And he's messed at the gate. He probably shouldn't push her luck. But he says, what's the problem?
Yeah.
He's making some rulings with David, but he's kind of checked out. He's really not realizing.
And he is the heir apparent. And so why not get some good practice and give some good decisions that favor the people? Ty? Yes. Yes.
Boy or girl, and how they can do no wrong. They're blinded by their faults.
Mm-hmm. Very good illustration.
I found a commentary that said, "He seduced the affections of the multitude, who neither penetrated the motive nor foresaw the tendency of his conduct. They looked past all the things, mm-hmm. or they just didn't see. Chose not to see."
Yeah. Very good comment. And I think if you're getting the decisions from him and the encouragement from him, you are going to overlook those faults. You're not going to care about what he does for somebody else. It's all about you. And then, Tim, your hand was up.
Yeah, I was going to say his humility was feigned. Because if he'd truly been humble, he'd gone to David and said, you know, I messed up here. I'm sorry. Can I help you with all these judgments that you're not able to get around to?
Oh, that.
He'd been an assistant rather than.
Yeah. You can't really see him doing that, but he should have if he were truly humble. Very good. Greg?
Yeah, the same thing. You've already kind of brought it up in regards to false teaching. The same thing happens today. It's a rationalization. David could have very easily have tried to rationalize away. It's not nearly as bad as it is. He's not doing that much damage. Look the other way.
Mm-hmm.
Brethren do the exact same thing.
Exactly right.
False teachers that are there, they're just ever churning. They're working the exact same campaign here. And brethren will tend to want to look the other way rather than to address it. And hence, we have many of the issues we have today.
And look at David's history. What had he done to Amnon?
Yeah.
Nothing. What had he done with Absalom up to this point? Nothing. So, yes, he's known for not disciplining, especially in his family. Steve?
I think what he's done is worse than nothing because he's tried to take a middle ground, not quite fully abandoning him or putting him to death, which is would be deserved, not really fully receiving him back. And I think sometimes we kind of take that path with people where maybe when withdrawal, we kind of make a halfway withdrawal. Or maybe when they come back, we kind of have a halfway reception. And with Absalom, David never committed to any one course of action. And that breeds the kind of bitterness that you see here, is where people don't know where they stand with each other. And the other thing about that is when David received him back, it was with no qualifications. And so, the story that the woman tells, it's, to make a way for him to come back. And David doesn't do that. Like Christ does with us, he pays a penalty for us. David, it's cheap getting back in the door.
And isn't it interesting that the next time you see David, after this episode that's about to take place, next time you see David speaking of Absalom, it's, "Oh, Absalom, my son, would God I had died for you. Oh, Absalom, my son." Now he has the full affection that should have been his. He should have taken care of the problem a long time ago. Very good points. Steve?
Rather than go to find out more about it, says, "Oh, we barely."
Yeah. Yes, immediately.
Just immediately was the response.
That's one of the greatest mysteries in this whole thing. And I don't have the answer for it. We'll see some things about it. But things had been allowed to slide and they'd slid long enough that now he's in deep, deep trouble. Any others? Okay. You look at verse 7. Now it came to pass after 40 years that Absalom said to the king, "Please let me go to Hebron and pay the vow which I made to the Lord." Now, 40 years, that's a long time to be putting up a coup attempt. So after 40 years, I guess anybody could cause a nation to fall. Well, we've got some issues here. There's a possibility, and you probably have a footnote on the word 40 in verse 7, let's say, the Septuagint manuscripts have it that way, the Syriac, Josephus, 4. Septuagint, Syriac, Josephus have 4 instead of 40. The manuscripts of the Old Testament, Hebrew, have 40. There's a couple of things. It could be that sometimes a copy has lost a little pigment in an area that would detail a number, whether it's 4 or 40, just one small mark would do. And so instead of 4 years, which we would have expected, it could come out 40. Or if it got smudged and something added to it, the same thing if it went from 4 to 40. Now, you also have the possibility that he's referring here, and if the 40 is what we should read here, of David's entire reign from the moment of his anointing as a young man till now, it's been 40 years. That seems to me to be a little bit of a stretch, but it's possible. Or it could be that he's referring to Absalom's age. I wouldn't doubt that he would be pretty close to 40. But surely something like that would be a possibility. But in any event, unless someone else has anything on that, in verse 7, it came to pass after, I would normally think about 4 years, unless you're speaking of Absalom's age or David's anointing, that Absalom said to the king, please let me go to Hebron and pay the vow which I made to the Lord. And so here you have a very strange situation. You have a man who's about to try to kill his father, overthrow him as king, and take his place as king, but he's so religious and so devoted to God, he's going to go to Hebron and fulfill a vow. And he uses God's name to carry out the deceit. That's as bad as it gets. But you see the same thing with Jacob. When Jacob goes into his father and he says, are you Esau? And he swears by the Lord he is, and that he got this meat because the Lord brought me this meat early, and that's why you didn't have to wait. So he uses a calling upon the name of the Lord in order to make sure that he gets his blessing. So it's not strange that someone would do this, especially if you're someone who grabs by the heel like Jacob does, or if you're someone who, like Absalom, wants something really bad. Matt, was your hand up? David doesn't say a word, but that's a good point. Hebron is the place where David had his first kingdom. 7.5 years he ruled there. Then he moved to Jerusalem. Maybe those people are still angry because David left. How would you feel if you had the capital here and it moved to Nashville? Oh, it did, didn't it? Or in this area. And the same thing with Murfreesboro. It was at Murfreesboro for a while. And I wasn't around in those days, but I was very grateful it's Nashville and not Murfreesboro, and I'm glad it's not here, because look at the traffic now. How would it be then? So there are all kinds of things to rejoice over if the kingdom's not in your city, but I don't know if they viewed it that way or not. But what you see is lying to cover up a coup attempt. That's very irreverent, very secular. He uses God's name in vain, to say the least, just like Saul would do. Saul would swear by the Lord and then take it back. He hated, of course, his father wanted to murder him. He's a sinful, rebellious child. He wanted to overthrow the throne and take it for himself. He declares peace, but he plans war, a typical proverb. And then Christians seldom are drawn away overnight. They get weaker over several years, and I suspect Absalom did too. We tend to drift, Hebrews 2, 1 through 3, rather than just get up one morning and say, I think I'll lie and commit some sins today. No, it usually occurs in a very slow, almost imperceptible way as we get weak over years. Any comments on this? Okay, let's see where we are. He stole the hearts. We talked about that. The fake religion, the lies, and going to Hebron. And then we'll work our way down to verses 11 and 12 at this point. In verse 8, for your servant took a vow while I dwelt at Geshur in Syria, saying, if the Lord indeed brings me back to Jerusalem, then I will serve the Lord. That's a facade. He's not going to serve the Lord. He's serving himself and himself alone. And we're told in verse 9, the king said to him, go in peace. Now, as far as I know, those are the last words David spoke to Absalom. And his words were, go in peace. I don't know where he speaks to him after this. So he arose and went to Hebron. And instead of going in peace, he went to prepare for war. Verse 10, then Absalom sent spies throughout all the tribes of Israel, saying, as soon as you hear the sound of the trumpet, today we would say, as soon as you get your tweet or your email, then you shall say, Absalom reigns in Hebron. Spread the news, like the siren goes off and people immediately know something's going on. As soon as you hear this report, Absalom reigns in Hebron, then that's to cause and effect. Verse 11, with Absalom went 200 men invited from Jerusalem, and they went along innocently, and did not know anything. That's one of the idioms you see in Scripture in several places, where it refers to the fact that a person doesn't know anything about a particular situation. But what the watchtower does in Ecclesiastes 9 or 3, either one, is to say, well, the dead know not anything. It goes on to qualify by under the sun. It doesn't mean they know nothing, and Luke 16 shows that they do. 1 Samuel 20, verse 39, when David and Jonathan are watching the arrows to see whether David should go or stay, remember the lad who went with him, it says of him, the lad did not know anything, and yet he sent him to get his arrows. How could he get those if he didn't know anything? He wouldn't know what an arrow was, would he? Well, it means he didn't know anything about this plan that Jonathan and David had. Job 8, verse 9, for we were born yesterday and know nothing, Bildad says. Did he know that he knew nothing? If so, that's one thing he knew. So what does he mean, we know nothing? Well, compared to God, we know nothing. And then you could see others in the same way. But if you look at verse 12, these men who go with Absalom know nothing about this plot he's designing. Then verse 12, Absalom sent for Ahithophel, the Galonite, David's counselor from his city, from Gallo, while he offered sacrifices, and the conspiracy grew strong for the people with Absalom continually increased in number. Okay, several things about this. One is this shows us a picture of what it's like, how you would go about it, sowing dissension, sowing discord, causing an overthrow, not just of a nation, but even of a congregation. The word that's used in Galatians 5, verse 20, the word dissensions, when he mentions here in these works of the flesh, dissensions and heresies are the last two words. We could note several words there, but it means strife and contention. And basically what you're seeing in passages like this, Proverbs 6, verse 19, for example, that these are things that were well known to God even in the Old Testament. Proverbs 6, these six things the Lord hates, yea, seven are an abomination to Him. Look at these seven things, and especially the last. A proud look, a lying tongue, hands that shed innocent blood, a heart that devises wicked plans, feet that are swift in running to evil, a false witness who speaks lies, and one who sows discord among brethren. You know whose name you could put right beside all seven of those things? I'll give you a clue. Absalom. He would qualify for all seven of these. Very few people I know would qualify for all seven, but he knocks a home run here. And so you see, it's very easy for a person to justify what he's doing because he's blinded by everything except his blind ambition. Now, verse 13, we've just seen this Absalom sent for Ahithophel the Galonite. That would be this little town right here. They're going to be in Hebron right there. What does that look like? 10 miles apart. So he's going to call for, Absalom's going to Hebron. He's going to call for Ahithophel to come. Ahithophel had been David's counselor. And his counsel was so great that it says concerning him over in verse 23 of chapter 16, now the advice of Ahithophel, which he gave in those days, this is 16:23, was as if one had inquired at the oracle of God. It's as though you went with a Urim and Thummim and says, what, God, do you want me to do? And God answers, he says, his was about that accurate. So was all the advice of Ahithophel, both with David and with Absalom. Bitterness turns the best qualities sour. And that's what takes place here. But as far as the advice he's going to give Absalom, he is spot on both times. And had he followed that advice, then Absalom probably would have had much more success against David except for God's intervening as he did with Hushai. Any comments? Okay, so here you have Absalom, the best looking man on the planet. Here you have Ahithophel, the smartest man on the planet, as his advisor. He used to be David's advisor, but he had a granddaughter by the name of Bathsheba. And he knew what David had done to Bathsheba. And the first thought in his mind is, what can I do to get even? And if that's not the reason for his forsaking David for Absalom, then I don't know. Well, in verse 13, a messenger came to David, saying, the hearts of the men of Israel are with Absalom. So David said to all his servants who were with him at Jerusalem, arise and let us flee, or we will not escape. We shall not escape from Absalom. Make haste to depart, lest he overtake us suddenly and bring disaster upon us and strike the city with the edge of the sword. Okay. Several things about this strike us as very interesting. Verse 12, the conspiracy with Absalom continually increased in number. He would help all these people at the gate. They'd go home all throughout Israel and say, David didn't do anything for us, but I'll tell you, his son, he is on the ball. He will take care of you. And that spread. He became very popular. Further, in verse 13, the hearts of the men of Israel are with Absalom. The majority now are with Absalom, not with David. Now, majority doesn't mean they're right, but that's the way it's going. And in verse 14, David says to all his servants who are with him, arise and let us flee. Here's the man who stood before Goliath and did not flee, but now David flees. Now, what is the reason? Did his courage fail him all of a sudden so that he said, I'm afraid of what will happen? Was he afraid that coming up from Hebron and the others coming maybe from the north, they would catch him in a pincer movement and he'd be trapped in the city and all of them would be slaughtered? I don't really think those are the issues. It appears to me that he's saying something about Jerusalem in here. Lest he bring disaster upon us and strike the city with the edge of the sword. All these innocent people can die unless I get out to a place where no people are. And so he goes to the wilderness. And if he wants to strike me out there, the few that are with me are at least soldiers and like soldiers. And it'll leave the innocent people untouched. That's the best I can do with this. And if you have a better statement, make it. And I'll probably say that's good. Any comments? Ty?
He does say us a lot.
Yes, he does.
Escape for us.
Yes. There are some that will leave with him. The strangest part, I think, is who doesn't leave with him. Verse 15 says, the king's servant said to the king, we are your servants, ready to do whatever my lord the king commands. So they know he's still the king. He hasn't been dethroned yet. Now, Absalom hasn't gotten his wish. But in verse 16, then the king, you notice all throughout this context, the writer mentions the king's servants, the king. Verse 16, the king left 10 women concubines to keep the house. So it shows that he's still the king. The writer is emphasizing David may be off the throne and out in the wilderness for a while, but he is still the king. It hasn't changed. God has left him as king. But why in this world do you have him leaving the 10 women who are concubines? If you turn back to chapter 12, verse 11, one of the specific promises God made after David had his fall with Bathsheba is 2 Samuel 12:11, thus says the Lord, behold, I will raise up adversity against you from your own house. I don't know what that means unless it's a son or brother's son or something. And I will take your wives before your eyes and give them to your neighbor, and he shall lie with your wives in the sight of the sun. David, knowing that, he could not have forgotten that. Why does he leave the concubines behind as an open invitation for part of this to come true? And I don't know the answer to that. I don't think I would have left him behind. Any comments? Matt?
I was just thinking, well, God said this is going to happen, so it's either going to happen like this, or they're going to be taken by force.
Or might as well not worry about it, yeah. That's the only thing I can guess about it. But I don't know. Tim?
I wonder if he doesn't know that it's a similar to Saul. He runs because he didn't want to have to kill Saul. Maybe he's running here because he didn't want to kill Absalom.
It may be. Maybe. Any others? Steve?
You know, they made a big mention as far as perhaps thinking that Absalom wouldn't come to Jerusalem if he knew that they were all out. So perhaps that, like you were noting, as far as that maybe Jerusalem was somewhat safe.
Okay, say the first part again, that he thought the concubines would be safe. Oh. If he's out, yes. Yeah, I can see that possibility. Yeah. Any others? Okay. If you look at verse 17, then the king went out with all. See, he's still saying the king that went out with all the people after him and stopped at the outskirts, at the last house as you're leaving this area. And in verse 18, then all his servants passed before him. He's taking a review. He's taking stock. Who's with him? And all the Kerethites, all the Pelethites, and all the Gittites, 600 men who had followed him from Gath, passed before the king. So here are foreign troops that are remaining loyal at a time when his own son's trying to kill him. So when you look at 13 and 14, all Israel, there's a landslide victory for Absalom. There's not been an election, but he's the one who's gotten all the power. David's been warned by Nathan. He submits. He hopes to spare Jerusalem. There's a civil war in Jerusalem. It would cost many lives. And so he gets out. But here in verse 18, the one bright spot so far, and there'll be a few others, are when these Pelethites, Kerethites, and Gittites all come, these Philistine bodyguards of David. And these are people that have true loyalty to him. The Gittites from Gath and Philistia, the place where Goliath was from. And we're told that they joined Israel expecting peace and strength. That David says as much to them. You joined when I was king. And there's a play on words about that word king with them here that we haven't seen yet. They find Israel more unstable than pagan nations. Here's a nation that if any should be stable, it should be this one. Because they're serving God. They're doing His will. They're righteous. But there's more intrigue and unrighteousness and outright lying and conniving here going on than probably any other kingdom. Those who sin like other nations can expect the consequences. Sin will bring disaster, Psalm 9:17. So Ittai stood by David in good times and bad. He's the one who's willing to serve even if it kills him. You'll notice now this attitude. Verse 19, the king said to Ittai the Gittite, "Why are you also going with us? Return and remain with the king. For you are a foreigner and also an exile from your own place." He's closer to David than his son Absalom. He says, "In fact, you came only yesterday. Should I make you wander up and down with us today, since I go I know not where? Why should you share my calamities? You came to share in my good fortune. And now why should I let you go with my calamities? Return and take your brethren back. Mercy and truth be with you." And the word mercy there is the word we've talked about a few hundred times. This covenant faithfulness, this loyalty, this supreme love that God has for a person. He applies it to these men who apparently are converts to the Lord and who are Philistines by birth. "Mercy and truth be with you," he says. That's one of the most exalted words in the Old Testament. And he applies it to these men. He thinks so highly of them. "But Ittai answered the king." Notice again, the king. "And said, as the Lord lives and as my lord the king lives, surely in whatever place my lord the king shall be, whether in life or whether in death or life, even there also your servant will be." So here he makes a vow to the king. The adversity proves the loyalty. No matter what happens to you, I am with you through thick and thin. The loyalty of the foreigner eclipses anything you could see in David's children, especially this son. So David said, "Ittai, go and cross over." Then Ittai the Gittite and all his men and all the little ones who were with him crossed over. Whole families, apparently. And you'll see a little later, during the battle with Absalom, Ittai will be one of the three commanders in the third division. Okay, comments over this? We have probably 30 seconds left. In verse 23, all the country wept with a loud voice, and all the people crossed over. The king himself also crossed over the brook Kidron, and all the people crossed over toward the way of the wilderness. It reminds you of David's flights from Saul. I got a New Testament picture of this area because it's so representative of the, I won't say type any type, but of the prefiguring of what Christ would do. Here you have the famous Kidron Valley on the east side of Jerusalem, the Hinnom Valley down here, for which we get the word Gehenna, hell. And you have a brook that flows through this part of the year. It's a seasonal brook. But you cross this valley and go up here, and there's the Mount of Olives that Jesus, years later in John 18, would have traversed this very area. This is how David leaves Jerusalem in the same way Jesus left and sat there and talked about the temple, what's going to happen to all these stones of the temple. That's where we are at this point. David's here. We're going to see down in verse 23, they cross this brook Kidron and make their way toward the wilderness. And then you'll see also down in verse 30, it'll mention David went up by the ascent of the Mount of Olives. And they went up weeping as they went. Steve? Yeah, I hadn't thought of that. Very good point. And somebody scratched his head. Any others? Thank you for your help tonight.